on this edition for Sunday, November 15th, a contentious transition as COVID cases continue to spike. Political organizers and their expectations for President-elect Biden. And in our signature segment, musical dynamo Cindy Blackman Santana. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Chlorfine Foundation, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular has been offering no-contract wireless plans designed to help people do more of what they like. Our U.S.-based customer service team can help find a plan that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thank you for joining us. President-elect Biden met with his transition advisors at his home in Wilmington, Delaware today, as the current president seemed to acknowledge he knows Mr. Biden won. In a tweet this morning, flagged by Twitter for unsubstantiated claims of election fraud, Mr. Trump said, quote, he won because the election was rigged. But shortly after, he tweeted, quote, I concede nothing. A group of federal and state election officials said in a joint statement Thursday, quote, there is no evidence that any voting system deleted or lost votes, changed votes, or was in any way compromised. But the General Services Administration, the federal agency which oversees the presidential transition, has not yet signed off on funding for the transition or approval for contact with federal agencies. President-elect Biden's chief of staff, Ron Klain, said the incoming administration's efforts to roll out a COVID-19 vaccination plan could be jeopardized.
Joe Biden's going to become president of the United States in the midst of an ongoing crisis. That has to be a seamless transition. We now have the possibility, we need to see if it gets approved, of a vaccine starting perhaps in December, January. Right. There are people at HHS making plans to implement that vaccine. Our experts need to talk to those people as soon as possible so nothing drops in this change of power we're going to have on January 20th.
In the U.S., the coronavirus continues to spike rapidly, and more than 1,200 people died from COVID-19 in just the past 24 hours. The New York Times shows an 80% increase in confirmed cases over the average number 2 weeks ago. Deaths are increasing at a 38% rate. In comparison, new coronavirus cases worldwide over the past 2 weeks averaged a 17% increase. Mexico has now reported more than 1 million cases, the 11th country to reach that staggering number. In Mexico City, where the mayor tested positive for the virus last month, all bars and restaurants will be closed for 2 weeks beginning tomorrow. In the U.S., where some states are reinstating restrictions this coming week, New York City saw one sign of relief. Schools will remain open. Mayor Bill de Blasio tweeted this morning that the 7-day test positivity average is at 2.57%, below the 3% that would trigger a shutdown of in-person classrooms in the country's largest school district. A federal judge has invalidated the Department of Homeland Security's suspension of DACA, the federal program that allows roughly 650,000 young undocumented immigrants to live and work legally in the U.S. Acting DHS Secretary Chad Wolf assumed control of the department last year and issued a memorandum this past July that effectively halted DACA. But in August, the nonpartisan Government Accountability Office said that Wolf's appointment was unlawful because it violated the Vacancies Reform Act. Yesterday's court ruling upheld that finding and found that Wolf had no legal authority to halt the program. We'll have more of the news summary later in the broadcast.
The battle to save our planet by getting climate under control.
For more on the presidential transition and the latest national and international news, visit pbs.org/newshour. We've been reporting on the record turnout this election of black and brown voters, which helped impact the political process, especially in battleground states like Georgia and Pennsylvania. Now, with the election over, many of the organizers who helped register thousands of those voters say the fight is far from over and want Democrats to deliver on centering marginalized voices. NewsHour Weekend's Yvette Feliciano has more.
In the run-up to the November elections, members of United We Dream, the largest youth-led immigrant rights organization, reached out to tens of millions of undecided Latinx and first-time voters across the country through phone banking and digital ad campaigns.
I know that, like, people like myself that have DACA have U.S. citizens in our families, that we had them and asked them to think about us when they went into the voting booth.
Gresa Martinez Rosas is United We Dream's executive director.
The record turnout of Latinos, of young people, of black and brown folks have been as part of like the long-term investment of organizers like myself, people in Arizona, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. So, you know, I think that there's work to do and we will not stop until we tell the story about how this turnout wasn't an accident.
The black and brown turnout did not go unnoticed, as President-elect Joe Biden acknowledged in his acceptance speech last Saturday night.
The African-American community stood up again for me. You've always had my back, and I'll have yours.
I'm not one for empty platitudes. The Democratic Party owes a great deal to the black electorate, and it's time to pay up that tab.
Black Lives activist and writer Sherelle Brown is based in Atlanta, Georgia, where politician Stacey Abrams is credited with delivering hundreds of thousands of votes for the Democratic Party.
There will be a number of articles that praise Stacey Abrams, that praise black and brown voters. But whether that translates into actual material benefits for those same communities is still the question.
Brown recently wrote an article for Essence magazine where she argues Biden's proposals for addressing anti-black state violence aren't radical enough.
The right has done this really wonderful job, actually, of painting President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala as this very anti-cop socialist ticket. But nothing could be farther from the truth. Biden and Harris both support giving more funding to police for things like anti-bias trainings or to diversify the force.
According to the American Election Eve poll 2020, which surveyed more than 15,000 registered voters, black voters named discrimination and racial justice as the second most important issue candidates should address after the coronavirus pandemic.
If only whites had voted, President Trump would have been reelected with about 56 or 57% of the vote.
Gary Segura co-founded the polling and research firm Latino Decisions, which helped produce the American Election Eve poll 2020. He's also the dean of the Luskin School of Public Affairs at UCLA. He says the media's homing in on Trump's success with Latinx voters in Miami-Dade County in Florida and the Rio Grande Valley in Texas paints a misleading picture of this year's Latinx voting bloc.
You're talking about a population that voted about 70-30 in favor of Vice President Biden. We think that Puerto Ricans probably gave as much as 71% of their vote in Florida to Vice President Biden. But it gets overlooked in Orange County and along the I-4 corridor because we spend all of our time talking about Cubans and Venezuelans and Dade.
Segura says, though Latinos voted in higher numbers for Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, 7 out of 10 voted for Biden in November, which is still above the historical average.
The Latino margin will exceed the victory margin in Nevada and Arizona and New Mexico and Colorado. Latinos will have elected Senator Hickenlooper, Senator Lujan, and Senator Kelly. We think Latinos gave over 120,000 vote margin to Vice President Biden in Philadelphia in the Southeast Pennsylvania region, which means without Latino votes, you would not have had the Vice President carry Pennsylvania. This is also true for African Americans, of course. So like in all victories, there are many owners, right?
Both Sherelle Brown and Gresa Martinez Rosas say a Biden presidency might mean more favorable conditions for their political organizing, but their fight is far from over.
Look at what's possible when people feel that they are part of the voting process, right? What Democrats should do instead of diluting the message or spinning away from their most consistent and loyal voting bloc is opening up more pathways for folks to be a part of the process.
How do we make sure that we are ensuring that Black folks and immigrants and queer people and women are not only being heard, put part of policy agendas, but as a culture, ensuring that there's restitution for those of us that have been directly in the target of Trump, which is why it's going to be so important to heal as a nation, to ensure that we are owning of the things that happened on our collective watch, and to be really committed to bold shifts in our society.
NASA and SpaceX are set to make history again when they launch their first operational commercial voyage to the International Space Station. The initial launch was scheduled for yesterday evening, but delayed due to weather. The next window for the launch, with four astronauts aboard, is scheduled for 7:27 Eastern Time tonight. I recently spoke with Dave Mosher, senior space correspondent for Business Insider, about the anticipated flight. Dave, we were supposed to have a launch and it was delayed. Any important reason why?
So SpaceX likes to recover the rocket boosters for this Falcon 9 rocket, this 230-foot tall sort of giant rocket that's going to launch these astronauts into space. This saves them many millions of dollars every launch. We're not quite certain how much. And they didn't have all the equipment they needed in place to recover that booster, in particular a drone ship, which will go out into the Atlantic Ocean and be there to sort of catch the rocket when it lands.
While space travel seems commonplace because we've been doing it for decades, this is still a giant experiment.
There's nothing routine about this mission. It is very much an experiment, just as spaceflight has always been since the very beginning, because we haven't hit that cadence, that repetition of flight. And anything can still go wrong. We're still really trying to understand these vehicles, and therefore they're dangerous, and they have a certain amount of risk to the people who are flying them.
And this one we're talking about, I mean, humans have only been on it once before, successfully.
That's correct. So Demo 2, which launched back in May, this was a demonstration mission by SpaceX for NASA to show that, yeah, we can get people to and from space safely, and therefore that's going to give us all the data we need to get through this very lengthy certification process that they've been working on for, you know, the better part of a decade. This constitutes the second crewed flight of the Crew Dragon spaceship and the Falcon rocket and all of the other things that go into it, the recovery operations, the ground control, mission control. This is all very new territory for SpaceX. They're still learning how to do it. They've shown they can do it very well, of course, on Demo 2, but, you know, anything can happen.
What's this mean now? If this one, let's say it goes well, does that mean that this is our system, that we're going to send people up periodically this way?
This is kind of the very beginning of what could be a very fantastic era in the human race, for the human race. We are talking about the first certified commercial spaceship. This means anybody can go on it, and that includes Tom Cruise, or maybe a TV contestant through Space Hero. You know, there's all these passengers who are sort of chomping at the bit to get on the space vehicle. So we are talking about, if this mission succeeds, we are going to have another demonstration that this vehicle is apparently safe to fly, and we're going to see more passengers go up more frequently. And it's also the beginning of an era for SpaceX. They're going to be in space continuously with humans from this point forward. They're going to, and at some points, they're going to have two spaceships with people inside in space as they rotate these crews on the International Space Station.
Finally, this is happening in the middle of a pandemic. What are some of the challenges here that they're experiencing now that they had less of last time?
I mean, one challenge we just saw was that Elon Musk, the CEO, chief architect, and founder of SpaceX, tested positive for COVID-19 just a few days before launch. And NASA had to go and backtrace all of his contacts over the past 14 days to make sure that he didn't interact with anyone or the astronauts that would have put them in danger. Because what you don't want is you don't want the coronavirus going to the space station and this tight, you know, air recycled sort of facility. Like, you don't want that to happen. And on the ground, we have all of these people who are working to prepare the vehicle, to check the vehicle, to put stuff inside of it, you know, very sensitive cargo. So there's all of this stuff that has to be done during the pandemic. And it's just added this several extra layers of challenges. So that the fact that we're seeing this happen relatively on time is a kind of an amazing thing in of itself. And I think it bodes well for SpaceX and NASA that they're able to do this and apparently pretty safely.
Dave Mosher, Senior Space Correspondent for Business Insider. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Great jazz drummer Max Roach once said, "I think that the rhythm sections, drummers in particular, are the unsung heroes of the music. Unsung, perhaps, because they seldom step from behind the kit and into the spotlight, but after decades in the business, one prominent percussionist is stepping out with a recent release that defies categorization. NewsHour Weekend special correspondent Tom Cachado has the story.
You might say Cindy Blackman Santana was born into her vocation.
There's this music thing that's, you know, running through the veins of our family, and mostly the women. My mom is probably my biggest influence ever. She played violin. She totally understood my desire for playing music. And her mom was also another incredible lady. She was a classical pianist.
I think a lot of parents, one might even say most parents, want their kids to be musical, but I don't know if most parents want drumming in the house.
No, they don't. When I first said that I wanted to play the drums, they said, "They're loud and they're expensive." I had to beg for a year to get drums. It was one of those like really cheap student model kits. And before that, I had the little Beatles kits from Sears. You know, they had the little blue Beatles design on the front and on the bass drum head.
She recalls being 11 and visiting an amusement park near her Connecticut home, where it wasn't the rides that attracted her.
I heard music, so of course I gravitated over there, and I tried to walk in the door thinking I could get in with my little ticket. And they said, "You can't come in, you're a minor," you know, because they were serving alcohol. So I snuck around to the side window and I peeked in, and I saw this guy with these hands, fast as lightning. I'm like, whoa, who's that old guy?
That old guy was a legend, Buddy Rich, and the music he played was jazz. She began to see a path for herself. It led next to a drum clinic where she heard jazz fusion pioneer Tony Williams.
And when he walked out, you know, he had the attitude, which was so confident and so full of life and energy. It was just incredible. And then when he played, I'll tell you, all my friends were into Star Wars at the time. And I went to see Star Wars. To me, it was boring after seeing Tony. That's how incredible Tony Williams was.
Soon, the young drummer was accepted to Boston's prestigious Berklee College of Music. And from there moved in 1982 to New York, where some great jazz pioneers still plied their trade.
That was an incredibly special time because Miles was walking around and alive and well, Dizzy, Elvin, Max, Dexter Gordon, Art Blakey.
Blackman befriended and played with Art Blakey, and before the decade was out, she was leading jazz groups and cutting albums of her own. Along the way, her musical identity solidified.
I'm a jazz musician. That's who I am. I just can't stop it. It's what I'm designed to do, what I'm designed to be. It's who I am.
She didn't mind, she says, that women drummer role models were in short supply at the time.
There weren't any women to look up to, but I didn't look at drumming like that, so I didn't feel like I was blazing a trail. I just felt like I was following the music that I loved, and, you know, I was following the drummers that I loved. I didn't care if they were women, men, or whatever.
And what about the way you were treated? Did you ever experience sexism as a drummer?
Oh, surely. Yeah, definitely. But, you know, I mean, that's nothing that I align myself with for very long, because it has nothing to do with my intention, has nothing to do with my heart, has nothing to do with my playing. I really learned very early on just to roll that off.
So you started leading your own bands. You're playing jazz. You're playing with great jazz players. And all of a sudden, you wind up in a video with Lenny Kravitz doing "Are You Gonna Go My Way?" That's not jazz, Cindy. I don't want to be the one to break it to you.
No, my friend, that is not jazz. You know, I hadn't really thought about a rock gig, but I liked rock, so I was okay with that.
From that point on, this jazz drummer's palette just got broader. She later joined a band known for its explorations of Latin rock and more, Santana.
She's a great drummer. She used to play drums with Lady Kravitz.
The group's leader would be her future husband.
There's a rumor going on. She's going to be my wife.
She brought an explosive style to the band.
Cindy is like Bruce Lee on drums because she's very devoted and dedicated and disciplined. So there ain't nothing cute about, you know, Cindy playing drums.
You know, the drums is the seat that really propels the music. You know, drums are the driving force. And we do it acoustically, you know, where if you're playing, you know, an instrument with an amp, you can just turn that down. You can turn that up or down. But drummers, you know, we do that with these.
Cindy Blackman Santana's latest project is a new album, Give the Drummer Some. And to call it eclectic almost understates the case. It includes fusion, pop, hip-hop, and of course, jazz.
She has a very distinct sound that she loves, a lot of command of her instrument.
Grammy-winning producer Narda Michael Walden worked with her on the album.
And she's very fastidious how she wants her things to sound.
The record also has something brand new for her, lead vocals, including her unique take on John Lennon's Imagine. It's easy if
you try. When I was thinking of it as a message that I liked and that I wanted to play in a rock funk kind of way.
Doing a rock-funk Imagine might be something a young jazz drummer never imagined. But at this juncture of her career, it makes perfect sense to Cindy Blackman Santana.
You know, drummers, we play with so many different people. Our job is to make that band sound as great as possible. And so we have to adapt with different rhythmic situations, with different textural situations. And, you know, I just really wanted to put out a record of a collage of things that I love.
John Lennon. Peace all over the world.
This is PBS NewsHour Weekend, Sunday.
Today, the leader of Ethiopia's separatist Tigray region claimed that his forces had fired missiles at the neighboring country of Eritrea in an escalation of what may become a civil war in Ethiopia. Tigrayan leader Debretsion Gebremichael told the Associated Press this morning that the attack was retaliation for Eritrea sending its troops into the region. The Eritrean government did not comment on the accusation. The Tigray region occupies northern Ethiopia, where it borders Eritrea and Sudan. Violence in the region has been escalating for 2 years. The fighting has forced some 25,000 Ethiopians from their homes into neighboring Sudan. In Israel today, a government agency opened bidding for construction of more than 1,200 new homes in a settlement near East Jerusalem. The settlement occupies a contested area that the Palestinian Authority claims as its capital under a two-state solution. The new homes would also seal off East Jerusalem from the Palestinian town of Bethlehem. The move comes just over a month before the inauguration of President-elect Biden, who has objected to Israel's settlement in the past, and days ahead of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's planned visit to an Israeli settlement in the West Bank, a stop previous U.S. Secretaries of State have avoided. A human rights group says that more than 500 people in Belarus were arrested today as anti-government protests sweep the country. In the capital city, police used tear gas and water cannons to disperse thousands gathered to protest President Alexander Lukashenko, who was re-elected in August under questionable circumstances. Tens of thousands of people have taken to the streets every week since Lukashenko's re-election. Today, protests came just after an anti-government demonstrator died of injuries, reportedly from a beating by security forces. Finally tonight, Iota is now the 30th hurricane of this Atlantic season. The storm is headed for the coasts of Honduras and Nicaragua tomorrow, a region still struggling to recover from Eta, the Category 4 hurricane that hit earlier this month. The official end of hurricane season is November 30th. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.